Hi there, welcome. This is the first edition of Earth Ancient, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. I'm your host, Cliff Dunning, and I am really excited to be bringing this program to you. It's March 8th, 2014. I'm here live in Oakland, California. It's a sunny day. These podcasts evolved directly out of the response I received from the Earth Ancients Facebook page, which is now averaging about 150,000 people a week. It reaches that many people internationally. And I am constantly getting emails from people asking me about specifics regarding articles that I've written and the number of articles that I post. So this podcast is directly for you. You guys will have an opportunity. Each listener has an opportunity to gain insight from this program. And there are a number of authors, investigators, and just general people who will bring their insights and knowledge to the program. Each of these programs is about an hour in length. And towards the end, I think what I'm going to do as we go forward is the last 20 minutes we'll have a question period if there are people that want to ask questions. And to ask questions, you just press 1 on your phone. These are archived. Each of these is archived, and you'll be able to see them on Facebook, but also on the Blog Talk Radio show, this show that is airing right now. So, I'm excited about this. This has been something I've been wanting to do for probably a couple of years, and the technology is now such that I can do it in the comfort of any place I'm at. I'm virtually at home today, but if I was on the road or traveling, I could set up this virtual studio, which is quite fascinating, have guests manage the entire program from the comfort of whatever living space I was at, of course, with a good internet connection. That's really the key. So today's guest, John Anthony West, my guest today. He has made his life work in the study of ancient Egyptian sacred science, its art forms, its spirituality, which is translated into many of the ancient buildings that are left to us. He's the author of Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, and The Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt, a guide to the sacred places of ancient Egypt. John came to the attention of the scientific community, actually in the international media, when he and Dr. Robert Schock, a geologist from Boston University, revealed that the Sphinx was significantly older than originally thought. Their work was presented to geologists, which was later debated by noted Egyptologists, where things really got kind of rocky. This led to a special TV program called Mystery of the Sphinx, which was hosted by actor Charles Ten Heston. The program was viewed by quite a large audience of over 30 million people. And it was so well received that John and, I believe, his production crew received an Emmy Award, which is high praise, because that means that it was, quite a good show. And it was excellent. It was so good it was turned into a video, which today, I actually took a look this morning on Amazon, and you still can purchase it for about $20. There's an expanded version. I guess it's a director's cut, which is about $24. We're going to play a segment here. In the video, we see Robert Schock explaining to this group of Egyptologists about the findings that he and West had uncovered, the geological findings that the weathering of the Sphinx was significantly older than what they had come up with. So we hear Lerner trying to explain away the possibilities of any kind of a pre-dynastic civilization, one that would be advanced enough to build a Sphinx in the nearby megalithic buildings. And what we're going to hear here is John's rebuttal, basically describing what he thinks the issues are. So here's an excerpt from the video.
Actually at stake are the implications, the impact it has upon accepted views of the evolution of civilization. We think, and it's a kind of a spin-off of Darwinian evolutionary theory, that human evolution is a linear process, that it goes from stupid cavemen to smart old us with our hydrogen bombs and striped toothpaste. In fact, the proof that the Sphinx is many, many thousands of years older, that it precedes by many thousands of years even dynastic Egypt, means that, and when that's taken into consideration and you look at the way the Sphinx is carved and the incredible size of the blocks of the temple alongside of it, when you take that into consideration, you realize that there was, at some distant past in history, as the legends affirm, high, sophisticated civilizations. So that's really what is responsible, ultimately, for the terrific opposition that the idea provokes.
So, John, welcome to the program. That was over 20 years ago. And has Dr. Lerner changed his point of view on what you and Schock found?
No, he has not. But whether he likes it or not, somewhere along the line, pretty soon he's going to have to, because his argument back then was that it was impossible for the Sphinx to have be dated back when we said it was dated. In other words, many, many thousands of years earlier, because it was all hunter-gatherers back then, and there was nobody capable of carving such a statue and building such a structure as the incredible temples alongside the Sphinx. Well, this is 20 years ago. I used to joke about his line was, "Show me a potsherd," and I used to joke that, well, it was a very advanced civilization. There are no potsherds. They didn't use pots. They used paper cups, which were biodegradable. But, I mean, I was joking, of course. But nevertheless, I mean, the water weathering is the water weathering. But since that time, we've accumulated a vast arsenal of smoking guns. Some of these smoking guns were local, as it were. They're Egyptian. Different aspects of the water weathering hypothesis or theory that fit together like a Rubik's Cube. There really is no evidence, no hard evidence whatsoever to rebut the theory. All there are counter theories, one of them put forth by Lerner, others by other people, which range from the just plain wrong to the ludicrous, and it's quite easy to show that they're ludicrous or just plain wrong. But the main thing was that the big smoking gun is found not in fact in Egypt, but rather in Turkey. Some of the listeners today may have heard about or seen clips of a site in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe. And this was discovered relatively recently, in the middle 90s or so, and it's been under excavation ever since. And it's a big, big site. It's a whole hill, actually, that was completely covered over. This is a really huge mystery, because it was deliberately covered over by whom we don't know, but we do know when it was covered over. And what it consists of, let me just backtrack a second. It was the head, anybody familiar with National Geographic, it was the lead article in National Geographic, I think it was May 2012, I think. Anyway, if anybody wants to Google it up, there's a ton of information on it. Spelled Göbekli Tepe, Tepe, two words. And it consists of about 22 closely adjacent stone circles, like mini stone henges, but not that many. These extraordinary structures have two central columns, big limestone, slabs of limestone weighing between 10 and 15 tons each, that come from a quarry downhill about half a mile, three-quarters of a mile away. And these limestone pillars are carved in high relief, meaning that the surface of animals and birds and all sorts of symbolic figures And high relief means that you have to carve away the surface of the stone in order to allow the relief, the picture, the sculpture, as it were, to emerge from the stone. Now, this is 10 times more difficult than carving into the stone. And the dating on this, which is this is the breathtaking bit of it, the archaeologist in charge of the excavations is an absolutely orthodox archaeologist, German, Klaus Schmidt, very careful worker, and he dates this enormous stone complex to 10,000 B.C. and maybe older, because as they continue to excavate, they're coming on some very slow work. They're coming upon other circles that they think predate the ones that they've already uncovered. And the reason that they can date them to 10,000 B.C., and they're in unbelievably good shape, they look as though they've been carved the day before yesterday, is because, for reasons that at the moment we can only guess at, they were deliberately covered over by somebody so that you didn't see these structures. In other words, you take a look at Stonehenge or the Sphinx or things in Egypt, most of these amazing sites were covered over to a certain extent by sand or silt or whatever, but you knew there was a temple there or a sphinx there because the head was above the sand. With Göbekli Tepe, it was just a hill. It was nothing there. A farmer whose land it was accidentally, with his plow, hit the top of one of these central pillars, and he thought it was just a boulder and started digging down, and he couldn't get the boulder out, so they dug some more, and then they realized they had found a column or a pillar, and one thing led to another, and there's Göbekli Tepe.
So, have you actually been to that site,
yeah.
John?
I've been in Chok's Ben a couple of times. It's really amazing.
And what would you say? Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, let me just finish.
Go ahead.
I was working very carefully, and Chok is a geologist, so he's very familiar with the ins and outs of all of these dating techniques. So he dates the fill to around 8,000 B.C., meaning that the structure has to have been there in order to be covered by the fill, 8,000 B.C., and so he estimates a 10,000-year date, more or less, this is rough, for these closely adjacent stone structures. So as far as Lehner is concerned, we still don't have a potsherd, but what we do have is a whole gigantic complex of 25 carefully decorated adjacent stone circles, like not so many stone hinges, and dated by the archaeologist involved in charge of the work at 10,000 B.C. And unlike the abuse that we had to put up with when we came up with our water weathering theory, the archaeologists are very silent on this one, but they acknowledge the dating. What they're silent about are the implications of the dating, because this means that, as we contended from the very beginning, and this goes back, it took me 10 years to find Chok, and this is a long story that we don't have time for on our hour here, which is the last 20 minutes of which will be questions and answers. I've been on this trail since I was doing my first, got commissioned to do the book on Shrala de Lubitsch, The Serpent in the Sky, and it was de Lubitsch who, in a book, the genius with the unpronounceable name, when one of his books, shortly before he died, but called The Sacred, translated as The Sacred Science, The King of the Pharaonic Theocracy, it was Schwaller who noted that the Great Sphinx had been weathered by water and not by wind and sand. And this came to me as an epiphany, because nobody had ever suggested this before. I think Schwaller himself did not realize what a bombshell he had discovered. And he died about a year after that book was published, so I don't know if he really realized how important it was, but I did, because I realized that if he could prove that the Great Sphinx, the greatest, the most spectacular sculpture on Earth, and its adjacent temples, which are built of blocks of stone that weigh upwards of 100 tons, slotted into place like pieces of a gigantic jigsaw puzzle, you would totally destroy the basic premise of what I call the Church of Progress, which is the credo of modern progressive rationalist materialist philosophy, which is, of course, as you said earlier, that progress is a linear process, starting with simple cavemen and going in a straight line up to wonderful old us with Disneyland and hydrogen bombs and drones and all the great stuff that we have at our disposal. So in and of itself, the water weathering to the Sphinx and its redating throws that entire, the whole paradigm has to be changed. And that in and of itself, you might say, because the people sometimes do say to me, well, you know, who cares if the Sphinx is 10,000 years old or 30,000 years old or 4,500 years old, as the academics claim. What difference does it make? The difference that it makes is that we watch our own so-called civilization, which isn't civilization at all, it's shiny barbarism, our technologically advanced era. We watch it crumbling in front of our eyes. I mean, everything that happens, everything, anytime we turn on the news, be it cable or network or, you know, the real news, which doesn't get much attention from cable and network on television, but it does on the internet, where you can actually access real stuff. We watch this crumbling in front of our eyes. And when Egypt is understood for what it really is, which is, again, the opposite of what the academics, who I call the quackademics, say that it is. And on my trips, I think we didn't mention this yet, I take study trips to the really pilgrimages to Egypt to introduce people to this extraordinary civilization. They recognize at the end of a couple of weeks the difference between what we call progress and what they call civilization. It is,
well,
it
let
is
me
a
ask
real
you a question.
Changer.
Let me ask you a question. I know that you go to Egypt at least once a year. When you're there doing your trips, have you discovered any additional buildings that kind of parallel the Sphinx or the Sphinx enclosure or the Sphinx temple that are as old as those structures?
Yes and no. Not so much structures, but elements on already existing structures that haven't been noted for what they actually are. And in fact, what you said before, we presented this at the GSA, Geological Society of America's annual meeting back in 91, and that's what started the furore of all of the press and the abuse, and that led to meeting up with getting introduced to NBC through a producer, and Charlton Heston signing on to do the voiceover. So the battle's been going on ever since, but we've been accumulating evidence ever since. And in fact, in 2000, we presented a lot of that evidence to another GSA meeting, but that one didn't get that much press, unfortunately. But the attending geologists, who were actually packed house of geologists, were almost 100% in agreement with us. And it's been that from the very, very beginning. The geologists have been completely convinced that we're right, and you see, to them, it's not a big issue because they don't have to change their minds about anything. It doesn't upset the science of geology. The people who it upsets are the archaeologists and the Egyptologists and the anthropologists, who have a profound philosophical stake in the Church of Progress, in the belief that we're the most advanced beings that ever existed. And along comes a theory for absolutely out of left field by me, based upon Schwaller's observation. I wouldn't have noticed this by myself, so it's really Schwaller's baby, and then backed up by Schock with his impeccable credentials. And now, as I said, a whole arsenal of smoking guns, the howitzer being Göbekli Tepe, that nobody's arguing with. So we're in the process, Schock and myself, and we're just about to get going on it, of trying to put together the funding to do a follow-up to the Mystery of the Sphinx that blows this whole thing wide open once and for all, and just in time before the whole damn civilization, if you want to call it that, crumbles in front of our eyes. I mean, this is real. As I said, this is not a quibble. between academics, it's understood. I mean, understood in its in reality, understood for what it actually is. Egypt tells us what a real civilization is like. What I mean, we wouldn't do this again. I mean, Schwaller's magisterial work, call it on symbolist Egypt. It's not that we're going to build temples, you know, temples of Luxor again, or carve sphinxes, or mummify our pharaohs, but rather, you see, Egypt was a one-issue civilization. It was entirely devoted to the quest for immortality, which, of course, is a wink, wink, nod, nod issue to the high priesthood of the Church of Progress. But it never occurs to them, actually, that, hey, maybe the Egyptians knew what they were talking about. They didn't just believe, they knew. And when we, as modern humans, take seriously the notion that our lives are not, we're not just here and gone tomorrow and that's the end of it, but that we have, at least in principle, a shot at immortality, which doesn't mean that we live to be 5,000 years old. It means that we develop our consciousnesses to such a level that when the physical body decays or is cremated, all the different civilizations had different ways of disposing of dead bodies, the illuminated spirit or the illuminated soul does not die. And that's the essence of Egypt. It's the essence of virtually every ancient civilization that ever was. And, of course, it is anathema to the priesthood of the Church of Progress. But you see, even from this, you know, I'm winging it here. If I were writing it down, it would be a lot more coherent. But you can see that what's at stake is a total revision or rethinking of everything we've ever been taught in our secular schools.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, that brings to my mind in my next question regarding the sacred science that you describe in Serpent in the Sky. Now, this sacred science must have been used in the creation of these, using these megalithic, monolithic blocks to lift them, to carve them. Now, can you describe or bring us up to date on what you have determined is that sacred science? Is it something that is tangible, or is it something that was some kind of a technology that was implemented through a use of physics that we don't understand? I mean, in other words, some investigators, some progressive archaeologists are using electromagnetic frequency detectors to that can measure subtle energy fields in megalithic stones. It's been done at Stonehenge. It's done in parts of Peru. And I'm just wondering if I have not been to the Giza Plateau, but I'm wondering, do you detect anything, or have you detected anything that might be a sacred science?
Well, actually, Cliff, the whole thing is a sacred science. A sacred science is not necessarily a specific technology. A sacred science is cosmology, actually. When I was talking before about the quest for immortality, that's a sacred science. Sacred is a polite word for superstition in the Church of Progress. But, yeah, the technology itself, how they did this, is still a big mystery. And there are a number of choices, but since nobody is able to, so far, nobody's able to reproduce an Egyptian temple with 100-ton blocks of stone, it remains, and this is a big question, actually, we don't even have time for it. If I spent the whole rest of what our 30 minutes is left discussing the technology, I wouldn't be able to come to a conclusion because we don't know. My guess is, just to cut to the chase, that it's some combination of an absolutely genius way of making use of what looks to us like simple or primitive means, probably allied with people having arrived at higher states of consciousness where they're capable of doing feats that we normally can't do at all. And there are plenty of instances of that kind of ability. the shamans have it in the rainforest. They perceive things in a different way than ourselves. There are recorded cases where, let's say, a woman's child is run over by a car, and she picks up the car and moves it off the child. She couldn't do that a minute earlier, and she couldn't do it a minute later. You have instances, for example, that extraordinary thing down in Florida of Coral Castle, where this one little guy, refugee from, where is he, Latvian, spent his life single-handedly working at night, putting together this amazing, it really is an amazing structure, utilizing 7 and 10 ton blocks of stone all by himself, and he would never tell anybody how he did it. So there are instances of people being able to do things under, trained sometimes accidentally because the situation simply demands it, and in certain cases being trained to be able to do those things. I mean, a really advanced martial arts master can do things that seem impossible to anybody else and are impossible to anybody else. So my guess is, excluding aliens, which I don't necessarily reject. I just say that I prefer to think that these amazing things were done by people very much like ourselves, but at a much higher level of development. The aliens, that's okay. I have nothing against aliens. I just don't see the evidence. I prefer to think that it's beings rather like ourselves, but just a lot more advanced.
Okay, so in your mind, a sacred science, a pre-dynastic civilization possessed technology to erect, carve the Sphinx and the Sphinx Temple. What would you say? By the way, there's some new evidence that and you may already know this, that the Great Pyramid, the Giza Pyramid, may have actually reveals to have been weathered at the base stones by sea salt. And the gentleman who has presented this is not a scientist, but his photo evidence is pretty compelling for seawater erosion rather than wind erosion. His name is Byland, and he is a retired Navy officer, and he was a journalist while he was in the Navy, and he has a small little book, an e-book, where he shows evidence of weathering on the base of these stones. And his theory is that at one time the ocean came up and surrounded the Great Pyramid, and this is the cause of the weathering. So I guess the question would be, was the Great Sphinx carved and put together around the same time that the Sphinx was?
The bigger question than you think, Cliff. To begin with, without seeing this book, I can't really comment because I haven't seen the book, but it won't work, I don't think, because the plateau is quite a lot of feet above sea level, and for it to get weathered by seawater, it has to have been in seawater for a long period of time, and I think geologically it just plain won't work. As for the Sphinx, however, even Lehner and the other Egyptologist archaeologists are happy with the theory that the whole of the Giza plateau it's sort of a unified pyramid plan. In other words, the plan is there from the very beginning. The Sphinx and the three pyramids and their satellite pyramids are all part of one basic plan, and we can prove. Actually, we presented this evidence at the second of the GSA meetings, that the Khafre pyramid, the second pyramid with the causeway joins, just goes down to the Sphinx, and the smaller pyramid, the Menkaure or Mykerinus pyramid, are built in several stages, certainly two, maybe three, and the earliest parts, which have been covered over, almost certainly date back to whenever the Sphinx was built. So what you see now is very likely very likely Old Kingdom, 2500 or so BC, as the Egyptologists say, but the evidence is all there to show that what's there now has been superimposed upon or replaces structures that were there earlier, and this includes the Great Pyramid as well, but the evidence is there is a bit more delicate. You have to really have it explained to you on site. It's one of the problems with an audio recording is that you can't see it. So I'm talking about all of these things, and on site, it all makes perfect sense, but just mm-hmm. as a stream of words unaccompanied by the photographs, it's you have to make what you can of it, but it's hard to actually prove it to people without having it in front of their eyes.
So
that's the basis.
Right. So based on your research on the Sphinx and the Sphinx Temple, these megalithic blocks, can you describe or do you find any other place on the planet that has similar types of stonework? I mean, there's a lot of different ancient ruins,
sure.
But I mean, would you say there's places that you would say parallel the craftsmanship of the Giza Plateau or the Sphinx and the Sphinx
sure.
enclosure?
Sure, sure.
Which,
Peru.
What?
Yeah.
So
Peru,
where? I mean,
of course, Cusco.
Okay.
Tiwanaku and so on. Peru.
Right.
Stonework. Stonework is very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Lebanon, which is not far away, with
Baalbek. Baalbek.
With Baalbek, and now of course the amazing Göbekli Tepe, which is not as spectacularly. Not the size and scope of the Sphinx and the Valley Temple, but what's the importance of the Göbekli Tepe, you might say, is that the establishment itself agrees that it's 10,000 B.C. or more.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I said, this is the game changer, and we're about to start a really concerted campaign to put the financing together to be able to do this big. Oh, and it goes other places too. Shock is very much into Easter Island as a part of this puzzle. I'm being of necessity a bit incoherent as we're going through this because the evidence is so there's so much of it, and it all locks in. It all relates to each other, but it's very hard to explain in just a few words in just a few minutes.
Of course,
all of this works and how it is related, but it really is. Coherent, it's like a big Rubik's cube where everything fits into everything else, and there's nothing that doesn't fit. In other words, there's nothing that disproves or rebuts the general hypothesis as it grows and as more evidence comes along to back up the original, the original premise.
Mm-hmm. So this follow-up to Mystery of the Sphinx, this video, or excuse me, this program that you, Shock, and whoever the producers are, would be presenting a worldview of a society, an unknown civilization, kind of what Graham Hancock presents in Fingerprints of the Gods.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay, so that's fantastic. So, yeah, that... I think you'd probably have over 30 million viewers.
Well,
see
we will if we
like
get
that.
It together. And see, actually, with this one, because network TV is not what it was in those days. That's 20. When is that? 20. Oh, it's so.
It
exactly
was 1993. Yeah,
93.
21.
We wouldn't want to. We probably could. The network wouldn't do it now. I mean, network's on its. It's on. They've got their problems, and they probably wouldn't finance a thing like this. Besides, what we're hoping to do, because the groundwork has been laid, is to do a really big-time production of film that gets a theatrical release to begin with in theaters. And the ground has been broken for that. National Geographic has a couple of really blockbuster documentaries that got their start in theaters. Michael Moore has laid the groundwork and, has had his documentaries done first in theater with great success. So we think we could fit right into that kind of a slot and get a and get a big program together that is not just the science, which, in fact, Mystery of the Sphinx was. It was basically geology. And now we would integrate it with all of these sites all around the world. We stuck with the Sphinx at the time because the other evidence, even though we had some of it, it was just you couldn't do everything in one 45-minute film, one 45-minute show. But we think that now, with all of this evidence at our fingertips and camera crews going around the world to show how all of these places fit in, and then at the same time, while we're doing that, also bring in, which we didn't in The Mystery of the Sphinx, the overriding theme of a sacred science, which we are absolutely convinced prevailed everywhere. It's just that in Egypt there's so much left of it that you can experience it, whereas in other places there's some left. For example, in South America, in Peru, you have all of this wonderful architecture, but you don't really know anything about the civilization that did it. Whereas in Egypt, we know a lot about the civilization that did it. Other things, for example, that nobody takes into consideration are the Paleolithic caves. These are masterpieces. These are some of the most incredible art that's ever been done. And they date back the best of the caves. The most spectacular is the most recently discovered, called Chauvet, C-H-A-U-V-E-T, discovered in 1994. And this is exponentially superior to the earlier caves of Altamira and Lascaux with the Hall of Bulls. And that dates, like, the archaeologists and the art historians date Chauvet to 31,000 B.C. So primitives are not doing this. They might have been hunter-gatherers, because who in their right mind would plant, go to the trouble of inventing domesticated wheat and all of these other things and dig up the ground when the food falls off the trees and the animals are all there to be brought down by, you know, either trapped or with bows and arrows. Who wouldn't rather hunt and fish for their food than dig up the ground? This is a consideration that nobody considers, they think. Anything, the closer it is to us with our stupid society, the more advanced it is, whereas, in fact, from my point of view, it's the opposite. The further back you go, the more advanced it was, up to a point.
So are you of the theory that there was a catastrophic event actually science is beginning to
absolutely
bow to that there was a single or a multiple events that basically wiped the planet clean of this advanced civilization? And what would you the time frame varies from 9,500 BC to 12,000 BC, which is roughly 13,000 years ago.
Go ahead.
No, I'm done. I wanted to hear what you're...
That Shock's baby. He's really on top of this. And he feels, and I go along with him, because actually this is a field where he knows a lot and I don't, that there are almost certainly two events. One is the event, probably cosmic in nature, maybe an asteroid strike or a comet strike or something like that, around 11,000 or 11,500 B.C., which sets up the, let's see if I get it straight, the Younger Dryas, it's called, in which, that's the one that sets off, I'm not sure if that's the one that's the mini ice age that freezes the woolly mammoths and things of that sort, but anyway, it's a global catastrophe. And then around 9,500 B.C., there is a gigantic, what's now called the Carrington event. Do you know what that is? The Carrington event, the last one called that because of the guy who named it, 1857, when there was this huge sunspot plasma strike, and it fried all the telegraph, you know, what was then the very primitive electricity that was around. And this was, at least historically, shock fields, a relatively small event of that sort, but it was nevertheless catastrophic for everything that was electrical back 150 years ago. Shock fields, that the time is ripe. These events, plasma strikes, have happened in the past, and if one hit us now, and a bigger one than the Carrington event, we would be in real trouble, because if the if a plasma strike took out our entire electrical systems around the world, we would be in a pickle. And
wow.
So he's not the doomsayer. He's not saying this is going to happen anytime soon, but he's saying that the chances are that it could be happening, and if it did happen now, it would be much infinitely more catastrophic than the event that happened back in 1857. So it's there. It could happen. Anyway,
okay.
Sock is pretty sure that there are these two separate events. The one that I think it's that it initiated a kind of a mini ice age, and then the other one, the plasma strike, that actually put an end to the ice age and initiated the long period of melting that we're still in the process. We're still in that. I think Sock calls it the interglacial period.
Right, but I mean, within that, there were some serious land changes. Obviously, massive water tsunamis that must have wiped the civilizations off the planet to the point where they were, you know, it must have been a terminating event. I mean, we talk about the dinosaurs being destroyed, wiped off the planet, but it must have been also a human factor that left us with very, very few clues, or there, it's buried, like in the where I study, which is the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
There's literally entire cities covered in soot and silt and sediment, which reveals that they were underwater for a significant period of time. So I'm just curious. Your feeling is that there was an event that would have destroyed this pre-dynastic people that built the Sphinx.
Yes. Yeah, we're very certain of that, but we don't have the details. We just have the broad picture. And it did destroy it, but it didn't destroy everything because, as I said, there's Göbekli Tepe, maybe built before one of those events. There are other things in Turkey. There are other discoveries that are being made that we think are dated incorrectly because they're too sophisticated to fit into the paradigm where real civilization starts around 3500 BC, so they're not permitted to be older than that, even though the evidence seems to support a much earlier date. These are all very complicated issues, actually, and some of them concern rather small objects like hollowed out stone bowls made of extremely hard material, and nobody can figure out. Even today, we wouldn't know how to hollow these things out because they're shaped like, let's say, like a flask that you have in your chemistry class, which is glass, of course. But shapes that almost defy explanation, and yet they're found in, let's say, with funerary remains, all the rest of which are very simple and primitive. And we hypothesize, we can't prove this, that these extraordinary stone bowls are a legacy handed down over the generations by people. And there are a lot of things of that nature, in fact, that if you look at them carefully, you see that they seem to be too sophisticated to fit into the time frame in which they're attributed to. It's obviously, you gather, that it's a very complex issue, and it's very difficult to explain coherently just in words without pictures. But anyway, sense of it. Yeah, that there's a double catastrophe, you know, separated by a couple of thousand years. a couple of thousand years. And the second one obliterates what, carefully in quotation marks, Atlantis, which is not anything that's sunk necessarily in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, but rather a name applied to that global civilization that existed and that did go down under catastrophic conditions.
If you're enjoying this program and have been listening to other Earth Ancient podcasts, I'd appreciate it if you would support our sponsor, Gaia. And Gaia is a streaming website that has first-class programs on ancient civilizations, pyramid culture, sacred geometry, and hundreds of special programs, special series on ancient wisdom, cultures that have left the earth, Atlantis. And then there's spirituality, wellness. Oh, I mean, there's this amazing programs. There's a whole series on NASA. And I really would appreciate it if you would support Gaia. And Gaia is offering Earth Ancient members a special offer for 99 cents for the first month. You can get full access to all these programs and many, many more, even the new programs. And to do that, go to gaia.com/earthancients. That's www.gaia.com/earthancients. And when you support Gaia, you support Earth Ancients. We need your support to keep developing the best program on the internet. All things ancient of the earth, all things present, and even into the future. Join us, join Gaia, support Earth Ancients. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's touch on that for a minute. I try not to use the word Atlantis in anything, but obviously Plato came up with the term, and it was handed down to him. So yep. it must be valid. What is your take on that? What is your take on a civilization?
Well, again, like all
as
of
advanced?
These issues, very complicated. There's an extraordinary book written by a musicologist and Sufi. I think he's still alive. He's 10 years or so older than me, called Ernest G. McLean, called The Pythagorean Plato, in which he decodes the Timaeus and the Critias of Plato as a musical allegory. Without going into the complexities of it, I'm pretty sure he's correct in that, and that it's a device put together by Plato intended to show musically initiated pupils how a high civilization becomes a tyranny through the laws of music, actually. I know this sounds weird, but believe me, the figures all come out as the figures all support each other. But what I think is the actual case, there's another good book, too, by a friend of mine named Jocelyn Godwin, called Atlantis and the Cycles of Time, that relatively recently been put out. And it's the complete Atlantis book. Everything you need to know about Atlantis and the various theories concerning it is in this excellent book. Anyhow, I think what the story is that Plato actually does know a story of the lost civilization handed down to him by Solon, who got it from Egyptian priests, and then for his own purposes, without any of the details. I mean, if you read Plato's Timaeus and Critias critically, you realize that how could he know all of these details? There are this many of moats, and they're this high, and the walls are so many, and this many soldiers, and so forth. If suddenly that's translated into a musical allegory, all of a sudden, all of that detail makes sense. But meanwhile, the geology of the Sphinx is the geology, and Göbekli Tepe is Göbekli Tepe, and all of the other evidence is very solid evidence. So we think that Plato got the story from Solon, as he claims, but then he invented or put together for his own purposes all of the details into this extraordinary musical allegory. So anybody seriously interested in it should not use the word Atlantis again until they've read the Pythagorean Plato and Jocelyn's wonderful book, Atlantis and the Cycles of Time.
I'll have to look into those. Let's take a couple of questions from our Facebook. These are written in.
Sure.
We have a couple here. Here's a question from Tom in Alabama. I've been to Egypt. The head of the Sphinx is distinctly different than the body. What can you tell us about the head? Was it always a pharaoh's head, or what do you suspect it might be?
That's an easy one, actually, and I can answer quickly. The head has almost certainly been recarved. It's in better shape because it's a much harder outcrop of stone, and then it's been repaired, you know, 100 years ago or so, so that it looks better than it is. If you look at old photographs of the head of the Sphinx, it's more weathered, a lot more weathered than it is now. But generally speaking, it's less weathered than the body of the Sphinx because it is a harder outcrop. It's too small for the body, so we're convinced that it was something else, but we don't know what, and there's no way to know what. Might have been just a lion. It might have been a head, but not the head that it is. There are lots of mysteries about the head of the Sphinx, including that it's travelers in the 19th century remarked upon it, and now it's not politically correct to suggest it. But really, the head of the Sphinx, particularly if you see it in profile, looks like a sub-Saharan African face, not like modern-day Egyptian face. And, of course, this is a bombshell discovery. In fact, I wrote the forensic work that Frank Domingo did for us when we produced Mystery of the Sphinx. It was Frank Domingo, because we said to him, you know, our travelers, we're always talking that this is really a black sub-Saharan face. And he said, well, it is consistent with sub-Saharan African physiognomy. I wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times on Frank's work back in, not sure when, 93, I think, before the video came out, and somewhere around there, 92, 93, and I carefully left out this theory that it was a sub-Saharan African face because I'm in enough trouble with the Egyptologist as it was. There's no point getting him even angrier. And sure enough, though, the Times published a letter a couple of weeks later by an orthodontist. An orthodontist is another expert on facial structure, who said exactly that this is a sub-Saharan African face. In fact, when we get our video off the ground, I say when rather than if, because I'm convinced that we will, and when we get it off the ground, we will address that possibility. Anyway, and briefly, yes, it's been recarved. Yes, that's the reason why it's in better shape, and that it is, of course, as I said, a much harder outcrop of stone.
So is it still your opinion that the original carving was of a lion?
Don't know. No way to know. Could have been.
Oh, no way to know. Yeah, interesting.
No way.
Okay.
Away.
Here's a question from Maria in Mexico City. She says, Zahi Hawass was kicked out as the director of the Giza Plateau. Do you think he is hiding some significant evidence? And if so, what might that be?
Well, he wasn't kicked out, really. Well, he kicked out when the revolution took place, and now he's back. Zahi, actually, after initially being, it's a long story, which I will put together in a book one of these days. We were bitter enemies, and now we're actually pretty good friends. He still hasn't changed his mind about the Sphinx and all the rest of it. But on a personal level, we get on quite well. And he's now back in favor. He's not back as the head of the Giza Plateau, and I don't think he wants it. He hated the administrative side of things. He loved doing the archaeology. He might know something that he's not telling people. He might, and I'm not sure exactly what, but there are certain indications, hints. And I've always felt that if the evidence were presented to Zahi in exactly the right way, and I hope to do this. He's promised to come around with me next time I'm in Egypt. He wasn't this time because he was back in America. Around the Giza Plateau, because it's never really been explained to him point by point by point by point, the details of the water weathering theory. And I've always felt that Zahi could turn around if he saw that he could, you know, not be jumped on by his fellow archaeologists and Egyptologists, he might turn. But it's more than wishful thinking. He could turn.
So you are on speaking terms with Hawass?
Oh, very good speaking terms. Yeah.
Oh, you are okay. Because
we go out and have dinner together and smoke the water pipe.
Wasn't he unhappy with Bivol recently for...
Bitterly. Oh, that's a real fight, yeah. And Bivol...
That's the lead to our next question from Steve here. There were two students who got into the Great Pyramid and took samples from inside the King's Chamber, I guess. And
The relieving chamber is above the King's Chamber.
Oh, it was really okay. But there hasn't been any word in America. But Steve wants to know if you've heard anything from any place in Germany where these two guys came from, if the analysis has been done and if it has led to anything.
No, I don't know if the analysis has been done. I know they're in hot water, those guys. My sense of it is actually that they're barking up the wrong tree, because I've been up to the relieving chambers on any number of occasions, and I'm absolutely convinced that Zechariah Sitchin tried to say that they were forgeries put in there by Howard Vyse, who blasted his way in there in 1837. I'm absolutely convinced that they're genuine. In other words, they're old, but they date from Khufu and back to our hypothesis, Shock and mine, that the pyramids are built in stages. We feel that the ultimate stage, in other words, that Khufu, whose name appears in those cartouches, and we find that very difficult to imagine that it's not true, because it's quite clear that these are very old inscriptions. Could they be much, much older? Well, in theory, they could be, but until that somehow or another proved, because you should be able to carbon date those roughly daubed paintings, because the paint should have organic material in it, usually it's egg tempera, so it should have, you should be able to date the paint. But until somebody does that, some way or another, we'll stick with Khufu as the builder of that final stage of the pyramid, and the earlier stages have been buried within the pyramid. Again, more stuff for the video that we plan on doing, or maybe a series of videos, because that's another big question. Very interesting evidence to support this building, multi-stage building.
It's funny though how these two guys, these students, got into the pyramid,
That's easy. Anybody can get permission to go in. What they did was see, to get into the relieving chambers, there's a long rickety ladder that they have to put up, because it's quite high. I mean, it's like 25, 30 feet high, and there's a hole in the wall that was cut in at some point or another. Well, maybe that's intrinsic to the structure. And to get up into those relieving chambers, that's where Howard Vyse blasted in with dynamite or gunpowder, whatever he used. And so if that ladder just happens to be left there, which was often the case, because it's a very heavy ladder, and so anybody can climb up there. I did it on several occasions and look around in there. So they got in there. The ladder was up there, nobody to stop them, and stupidly chipped away a couple of little pieces of the markings of the paint.
Right, right. Interesting.
It's no big secret. It's easy.
Interesting. So
not
here's
easy
a
now
here's
cause they're taking the ladder down.
Here's a question from Sandy in San Jose. She says, and I'm going to try to decipher her writing here. She says, Mark Lerner, Dr. Lerner, studied Edgar Cayce's, apparently she says he was a proponent of Edgar Cayce. Why turn on the alternative position and poo-poo your work? I don't understand that. I think what she's saying is that he was funded by Lerner, wasn't he? I don't think...
No, it's more than that. Also, more complicated. No, he was absolutely a Cayceite, but either because combination, if he wanted to be an Egyptologist, he was not going to be able to do that and be an advocate of Cayce's work. Also, it's complicated, because Cayce said that the pyramid and the Sphinx was much, much older, but a date of 10,000 B.C. on it. But, in fact, when Lehner was doing, when Lehner was getting his PhD and, you know, becoming the big expert on the whole of the Giza Plateau, he turned. But he turned because the evidence, in part, because the evidence did not support Casey, except for this one aspect of it being much older. Then, I mean, Serpent in the Sky is published in 78, and there I developed the Sphinx theory long before I met Schock. So, of course, I'm not a geologist, so that carried very little weight with the academics. Bad enough when you've got a highly credentialed Yale PhD geologist backing up the theory. With me, of course, they were just paying no attention at all. But I, in fact, met up with Lehner in 1980 or so, and he just didn't want to know. He'd already cast his die with the Orthodox school, and in fact, even the Casey people didn't want to know. They're as blinkered as just about everyone else. They didn't want it to be proved by geology. They wanted to find the Casey, the Hall of Records. Speaking of which, our seismographs have detected, this is again ignored by Zahi and by everyone else, our seismographs tell us that there is a chamber of some sort underneath the left paw of the Sphinx, and the seismograph doesn't channel. It was Casey channeled his information, but the seismograph doesn't know how to channel. So this is another big thing that everyone always asks about, but again, complicated because nobody's going to go digging down in there for a variety of reasons. Anyway, not until we establish this water, the dating and the water weathering in such a way that they just can't argue anymore. But Lehner,
interesting.
Yeah, Lehner, I really blame. I really hold responsible because he's a smart guy, and there's the geological evidence and his own theory that it's complicated, that the flaking that's going on at present could account for the extreme water weathering to the Sphinx. And if you're in Egypt with me, I'll show everyone in 3 minutes how that theory absolutely doesn't hold. So Lehner had an opportunity to jump on the geology right from the get-go and stop, you know, and forestall 20 years of battling these guys. So it should be an interesting meeting if and when we get our video done and address the show me a pot shot argument.
Exactly. Here's a question from Amir in New York. He says, Andrew Collins' book on Lost Caves of Giza describes these caves that apparently go under a good portion of the plateau. Have you had a chance to go into any of these caves? And if so, what is your opinion of a system that may have carried electricity or other properties through the plateau?
You know, I haven't been in those caves, and I'm not exactly sure where they are. But so I can't really comment positively or negatively about it, but I don't think it's a question of carrying electricity through, because that's not the way they worked with things. But without having been there, and I know Colin, without having been there and taken a good look for myself, which I should do, actually. I mean, it just doesn't occur to me, hasn't occurred to me when I'm there. I'll beg out of that one, because there's no point.
Okay.
Giving an answer when I really don't know.
Sure, no sweat. And here's we're just gonna make this our final. This is from John in Santa Barbara. He says he loves your work, and he wants to know what you would like to be remembered for. I don't know what that. I guess that's not an obituary,
think,
but more what your.
actually, in one sense, I don't care. For making a lot of trouble, I think. And
rock the boat.
And,
yeah.
And as you probably know, I wear a couple of different hats. You know, I started out as a novelist and playwright and screenwriter and stuff like that, which interests me quite as much as the Egyptology. I guess, the Sphinx theory is the Sphinx theory, and it's a paradigm changer. And if I'm going to be remembered for anything other than being able to tell jokes very well, I like to think maybe it's the Sphinx theory.
Yes, definitely. I would think that that one puts you definitely on the map as well as a shock.
Though, yeah, that's
interesting.
Not, that's not going away.
Yeah, I don't think it is. We have just a few minutes, John. I want you to describe for us your tours, because I didn't really bring that up, but they sound
right.
Fascinating. Do you provide a specific agenda when you're in Egypt? Is it
Absolutely.
One area you typically go to? Can you talk a little bit about that?
No, we do the whole thing. These are 14-day tours, and they're relatively reasonably priced, considering we do. You know, we have a 2-hour meditation, private meditation session in the Great Pyramid, and a couple of hours private visit to the Sphinx enclosure, and a lot of things that we do that don't get done at all. And these are high intensive study tours. And I just realized this tour I just came back from. Really, they're a pilgrimage. These are sacred. These are holy sites. And there's a wonderful one of the best books on travel to Egypt is written. It's a collection of letters by Florence Nightingale, who was there in 1849. And she says, one wonders that people come back from Egypt and live lives the way they lived them before. And this is really true. I mean, this is, you know, I've been running these trips now for close on to 30 years. And I started in 85. And the common theme is, 85, yeah, almost, yeah, going on 30 years. The common theme of virtually everyone who comes back understanding the difference between progress and civilization. I mean, you come back from Egypt, and I start off lectures by saying Egypt is like sex, and that gets everybody's interest up. And why is it like sex? Because you can read all about it, and that's interesting, and you can look at pictures, and that's even maybe more interesting. But until you've experienced it, you do not understand it. And Egypt is like that. However good the books, however good the videos, until you're actually there, standing in the middle of these unbelievable structures, and then having experienced it, having explained through Swala's symbolist interpretation, it's a life-changing experience.
Fantastic.
It is genuinely transformational, which is not a word that I like to bandy about.
Wow.
So
we have just a few minutes. What would you like to leave us with in terms of your work, this upcoming program that you and Shock are trying to produce, which I believe would be a big, big success if it was ever put together. But what would you like to leave us with? What would you like to leave us with today?
That's pretty much what I'd like to leave you with. I mean, the trips are the trips, and of course, they're not cheap, but they're given what they offer, and they're unique. I mean, there are only a handful of people who understand Shrala well enough to retransmit it, and it just so happens that I happen to be the only one doing trips. So, and you know, it's all hands on, and I'm with everyone all day long. So the trips are the goal. That said, the books are. My books, and also there's the marvelous eight episode DVD called Magical Egypt, The Symbolist Tour, all of that stuff you can get from me personally. The DVD series, I don't think you even know about that. Clip.
Is it on Amazon?
But it's the next best. I'm not even sure if it's on Amazon, but I have them.
Okay.
Go to my website, you can get them from me.
Very good.
They're the next best thing to actually visiting Egypt, because they've really been my partner in this, a guy called Chance Gardner, who's absolutely brilliant as an editor. And he's put together this. It's done on a shoestring, so the visual quality is not perhaps what we might like it to be, but it really is. It's really impressive. I mean, no week goes by. You can actually, it's been pirated, so you can actually get it for nothing, but it has a bad quality on the internet. Really, that's unfair. We've been in all these years of work, and I'd like to get my hands on some of those pirates, actually. They might not pirate again. I'll leave you with that.
John Anthony West, it's been a pleasure, and
thanks,
I hope we can talk to you again, and I look forward to more from you. I know that I do read from Shock occasionally. He
right.
seems to be still writing. And
very much.
Are you going to have a follow-up to Serpent in the Sky? Are you ever going to produce?
Well, actually, Shock and I have two books planned. One, the whole
Wonderful.
Story of the Sphinx Theory, with all the stories and Zaki and everything and Lehner and all of that stuff. And then another one, this is another subject for another time. Shock and I hope to write the definitive anti-Darwin book.
Well,
and
again, it's a pleasure, and we're at the end of the show, and
right.
I thank you again, and
thank you.
We will.